Watching a living man disemboweled or brained had filled him with a kind of deep shame that the ultimate inner secrets of the human body could be so grossly exposed. He felt unclean. He removed his clothing in the chilly bathhouse and, even without thinking, the silver amulet Mr. Wolf and Aunt Paul had given him. And then he entered the steaming tub where he scrubbed at his skin with a coarse brush and strong soap, much harder than even the most meticulous obsession with personal cleanliness would have required. For the next several days, they moved southward at a steady pace, stopping each night at the evenly spaced Tolnedron hostels, where the presence of the hard-faced legionnaires was a continual reminder that all of the might of Imperial Tolnedra guaranteed the safety of travelers who sought refuge there. On the sixth day after the fight in the forest, however, Lalderan's horse pulled up lame. Durnek and Hetar, under Aunt Paul's supervision, spent several hours brewing poultices over a small fire by the roadside and applying steaming compresses to the animal's leg, while Wolf fumed at the delay. By the time the horse was fit to continue, they all realized that there was no chance to reach the next hostel before dark.
"Well, old Wolf," Aunt Paul said after they had remounted, "what now? Do we ride on at night, or do we try to take shelter in the forest again?"
"I haven't decided," Wolf answered shortly.
"If I remember right, there is a village not far ahead," Lalderan, now mounted on an Algar horse, stated. "It is a poor place, but I think it has an inn. Of sorts."
"Oh, that sounds ominous," Silk said. "What exactly do you mean by of sorts?"
"The lord of this demesne is notoriously greedy. His taxes are crushing, and his people have little left for themselves. The inn is not so good."
"We'll have to chance it," Wolf decided, and led them off at a brisk trot.
As they approached the village, the heavy clouds began to clear off, and the sun broke through wanly. The village was even worse than Lalderan's description had led them to believe. A half-dozen ragged beggars stood in the mud on the outskirts, their hands held out imploringly and their voices shrill. The houses were nothing more than rude hovels oozing smoke from the pitiful fires within. Scrawny pigs rooted in the muddy streets, and the stench of the place was awful. A funeral procession slogged through the mud toward the burial ground on the other side of the village. The corpse, carried on a board, was wrapped in a ragged brown blanket, and the richly robed and cowled priests of Khaldan, the Erendish god, chanted an age-old hymn that had much to do with war and vengeance, but little to do with comfort. The widow, a whimpering infant at her breast, followed the body, her face blank and her eyes dead. The inn smelled of stale beer and half-rotten food. A fire had destroyed one end of the common room, charring and blackening the low-beamed ceiling. The gaping hole in the burned wall was curtained off with a sheet of rotting canvas. The fire pit in the center of the room smoked, and the hard-faced innkeeper was surly. For supper he offered only bowls of watery gruel, a mixture of barley and turnips.
"Oh, charming,"
Silt said sardonically, pushing away his untouched bowl.
"I am a bit surprised at you, Lalderan. Your passion for correcting wrongs seems to have overlooked this place. Might I suggest that your next crusade include a visit to the lord of this domain? His hanging seems long overdue."
"I had not realized that it was so bad,"
Lalderan replied in a subdued voice. He looked around as if seeing certain things for the first time. A kind of sick horror began to show itself in his transparent face. Geryon, his stomach churning, stood up.
"I think I'll go outside."
"Not too far,"
Aunt Paul warned. The air outside was at least somewhat cleaner, and Geryon picked his way carefully toward the edge of the village, trying to avoid the worst of the mud.
"Please, my lord?"
A little girl with huge eyes begged.
"Have you a crust of bread to spare?"
Geryon looked at her helplessly.
"I'm sorry."
He fumbled through his clothes, looking for something to give to her, but the child began to cry and turned away. In the stump-dotted field beyond the stinking streets, a ragged boy about Geryon's own age was playing a wooden flute as he watched a few scrubby cows. The melody he played was heartbreakingly pure, drifting unnoticed among the hovels, squatting in the slanting rays of the pale sun. The boy saw him, but did not break off his playing. Their eyes met with a kind of grave recognition, but they did not speak. At the edge of the forest, beyond the field, a dark-robed and hooded man astride a black horse came out of the trees and sat, watching the village. There was something ominous about the dark figure, and something vaguely familiar as well. It seemed somehow to Geryon that he should know who the rider was, but though his mind groped for a name, it tantalizingly eluded him. He looked at the figure at the edge of the woods for a very long time, noticing without even being aware of it that though the horse and rider stood in the full light of the setting sun, there was no shadow behind them. Deep in his mind, something tried to shriek at him, but all bemused, he merely watched. He would not say anything to Aunt Paul or the others about the figure at the edge of the woods, because there was nothing to say. As soon as he turned his back, he would forget. The light began to fade, and because he had begun to shiver, he turned to go back to the inn, with the aching song of the boy's flute soaring toward the sky above him. Chapter 6. Despite the promise of the brief sunset, the next day dawned cold and murky, with a chill drizzle that wreathed down among the trees and made the entire forest sodden and gloomy. They left the inn early and soon entered a part of the wood that seemed more darkly foreboding than even the ominous stretches through which they had previously passed. The trees here were enormous, and many vast, gnarled oaks lifted their bare limbs among the dark firs and spruces. The forest floor was covered with a kind of gray moss that looked diseased and unwholesome. Lulderan had spoken little that morning, and Geryon assumed that his friend was still struggling with the problem of Nachak's scheme. The young Asturian rode along, wrapped in his heavy green cloak, his reddish-gold hair damp and dispirited-looking in the steady drizzle. Geryon pulled in beside his friend, and they rode silently for a while.
"What's troubling you, Leldrin?" he asked finally.
"I think that all my life I have been blind, Geryon," Leldrin replied.
"Oh? In what way?"
Geryon said it carefully, hoping that his friend had finally decided to tell Mr. Wolf everything.
"I saw only Mimbre's oppression of Asturia. I never saw our own oppression of our own people."
"I've been trying to tell you that," Geryon pointed out. "What made you see it finally?"
"That village where we stayed last night," Leldrin explained. "I have never seen so poor and mean a place, or people crushed into such helpless misery. How can they bear it?"
"Do they have any choice?"
"Well, my father at least looks after the people on his land,"
the young man asserted defensively.
"No one goes hungry or without shelter. But those people, they're treated worse than animals. I've always been proud of my station, but now it makes me ashamed."
Tears actually stood in his eyes now. Geryon was not sure how to deal with his friend's sudden awakening. On the one hand, he was glad that Leldrin had finally seen what had always been obvious, but on the other, he was more than a little afraid of what this newfound perception might cause his mercurial companion to leap into.
"I will renounce my rank," Leldrin declared suddenly, as if he had been listening to Geryon's thoughts. "And when I return from this quest, I'll go among the serfs and share their lives, their sorrows."
"What good will that do? How would your suffering in any way make theirs less?"
Leldrin looked up sharply, a half-dozen emotions chasing each other across his open face. Finally, he smiled, but there was determination in his blue eyes.
Yeah, you are right, of course. You always are. It's amazing how you can always see directly to the heart of a problem, Geryon.
Just what have you got in mind? Geryon asked a little apprehensively.
I will lead them in a revolt. I will sweep across Orindia with an army of serfs at my back.
His voice rang as his imagination fired with the idea.
Geryon groaned.
Why is that always your answer to everything, Lalduran?
He demanded.
In the first place, the serfs don't have any weapons, and they don't know how to fight. No matter how hard you talk, you'd never get them to follow you. In the second place, if they did, every nobleman in Orindia would join ranks against you. They'd butcher your army, and afterward things would be 10 times worse. In the third place, you'd just be starting another civil war, and that's exactly what the Murgos want.
Lalduran blinked several times as Geryon's words sank in. His face gradually grew mournful again.
I had not thought of that, he confessed.
I didn't think you had.
You're going to keep making these mistakes as long as you keep carrying your brain in the same scabbard with your sword, Lalduran. Lalduran flushed at that, and then he laughed ruefully.
That is a pointed way of putting it, Geryon, he said reproachfully.
I'm sorry,
Geryon apologized quickly.
Maybe I should have said it another way.
No, Lalduran told him. I'm an errand. I tend to miss things if they are not said directly.
Well, it's not that you're stupid, Lalduran,
Geryon protested.
That's a mistake everyone makes. Our ends aren't stupid. They're just impulsive.
All this was more than just impulsiveness,
Lalduran insisted sadly, gesturing out at the damp moss lying under the trees.
This what?
Geryon asked, looking around.
This is the last stretch of forest before we come out on the plains of central Orindia. It is the natural boundary between Mimbre and Asturia.
The woods look all the same as the rest,
Geryon observed, looking around.
Not really,
Lotharin said somberly.
This was the favorite ground for ambush. The floor of this forest is carpeted with old bones. Look there,
he pointed. At first it seemed to Geryon that what his friend indicated was merely a pair of twisted sticks protruding from the moss, with the twigs at their ends entangled in a scrubby bush. Then, with revulsion, he realized that they were the greenish bones of a human arm, the fingers clutched at the bush in a last convulsive agony. Outraged, he demanded,
"Why didn't they bury him? It would take 1,000 men 1,000 years to gather all the bones that lie here and commit them to the earth,"
Lalduran intoned morbidly.
"Whole generations of Orindia rest here. Mimbreit, Rasait, Asturian. All lie where they fell, and the moss blankets their endless slumber."
Geryon shuddered and pulled his eyes away from the mute appeal of that lone arm rising from the sea of moss on the floor of the forest. The curious lumps and hummocks of that moss suggested the horror which lay moldering beneath. As he raised his eyes, he realized that the uneven surface extended as far as he could see.
"How long until we reach the plain?"
he asked in a hushed voice.
"2 days, probably." 2 days? And it's all like this?
Lalduran nodded.
Why?
Geryon's tone was harsher, more accusing than he had intended.
At first for pride and honor,
Lalduran replied.
Later for grief and revenge. Finally it was simply because we did not know how to stop. As you said before, sometimes we are friends, we are not very bright.
But always brave,
Geryon answered quickly.
Oh, yes, Lalduran admitted. Always brave. It is our national curse.
Belgarath, Hetar said quietly from behind them. The horses smell something.
Mr. Wolf roused himself from the doze in which he usually rode.
What? The horses, Hetar repeated. Something is out there frightening them.
Wolf's eyes narrowed and then grew strangely blank. After a moment he drew in a sharp breath with a muttered curse.
"Elgroths,"
he swore.
"What's an Elgroth?"
Dernick asked.
"A non-human, somewhat distantly related to trolls." "I saw a troll once,"
Beric said.
"A big ugly thing with claws and fangs."
"Will they attack us?"
Dernick asked.
"Almost certainly."
Wolf's voice was tense.
"Hetar, you're going to have to keep the horses under control. We don't dare get separated."
"Where did they come from?" Lauderin asked. "There aren't any monsters in this forest."
"They came down up to the mountains of Ulgo. Sometimes they do so when they're hungry,"
Wolf answered.
"They don't leave survivors to report their presence."
"You had better do something, father,"
Aunt Paul said.
"They're all around us."
Lauderin looked quickly around as if getting his bearings.
"We are not far from Ilgon's Tor. We might be able to hold them off if we get there."
"Ilgon's Tor?" Beric said.
He had already drawn his heavy sword.
"It is a high hillock covered with boulders,"
Lauderin explained.
"It's almost like a fort. Ilgon held it for a month against a Mimbrate army."
"Sounds promising," Silk said. "It would get us out of the trees, at least." He looked nervously around at the forest, looming about them in drizzling rain.
"Let's try for it,"
Wolf decided.
"They haven't worked themselves up to the point of attacking yet. And the rain's confusing their sense of smell."
A strange barking sound came from back in the forest.
"Is that them?"
Garion asked, his voice sounding shrill in his own ears.
"They're calling to each other,"
Wolf told him.
"Some of them have seen us. Let's pick up the pace a bit, but don't start running until we see the Tor."
They nudged their nervous horses into a trot and moved steadily along the muddy road as it began to climb toward the top of a low ridge.
"Half a league,"
Lauderin said tensely.
"Half a league and we should see the Tor."
The horses were difficult to hold in, and their eyes rolled wildly at the surrounding woods. Garion felt his heart pounding, and his mouth was suddenly dry. It started to rain a bit harder. He caught a movement out of the corner of his eye and looked quickly. A man-like figure was loping along parallel to the road, about 100 paces back in the forest. It ran half-crouched, its hands touching the ground. It seemed to be a loathsome gray color.
"Over there!"
Garion cried.
"I saw him," Beric growled. "Not quite as big as a troll."
Silk grimaced.
"Big enough."
"If they attack, be careful of their claws,"
Wolf warned.
"They're venomous."
"Oh, that's exciting," Silk said.
"There's the Tor,"
Aunt Paul announced quite calmly.
"Let's run,"
Wolf barked. The frightened horses, suddenly released, leaped forward and fled up the road, their hooves churning. An enraged howl came from the woods behind them, and the barking sound grew louder all around them.
"We're going to make it,"
Dernick shouted in encouragement. But suddenly a half-dozen snarling Elgroths were in the road in front of them, their arms spread wide and their mouths gaping hideously. They were huge, with ape-like arms and claws instead of fingers. Their faces were goatish, surrounded by short, sharp-pointed horns, and they had long, yellow fangs. Their gray skin was scaly and reptilian. The horses screamed and one reared, trying to bolt. Garion clung to his saddle with one hand and fought the reins with the other. Barak beat at his horse's rump with the flat of his sword and kicked savagely at the animal's flanks until the horse, finally more afraid of him than the Algroths, charged. With two great sweeps, one to either side, Barak killed two of the beasts as he plunged through. A third, claws outstretched, tried to leap on his back, but stiffened and collapsed face down in the mud, with one of Lauldurin's arrows between its shoulders. Barak wheeled his horse and chopped at the three remaining creatures.
"Let's go!"
he bellowed. Garion heard Lauldurin gasp and turned quickly. With sick horror, he saw that a lone Algroth had crept out of the woods beside the road and was clawing at his friend, trying to hook him out of the saddle. Weakly, Lauldurin beat at the goat face with his bow. Garion desperately drew his sword, but Hetar, coming from behind, was already there. His curved saber ran through the beast's body, and the Algroth shrieked and fell, writhing to the ground, beneath the pounding hooves of the pack animals. The horses, running now in sheer panic, scrambled toward the slope of the boulder-strewn tor. Geryon glanced back over his shoulder and saw Loldrin swaying dangerously in his saddle, his hand pressed to his bleeding side. Geryon pulled in savagely on his reins and turned his horse.
"Save yourself, Geryon!"
Loldrin shouted, his face deadly pale. "No!" Geryon sheathed his sword, pulled in beside his friend and took his arm, steadying him in the saddle. Together they galloped toward the tor, with Geryon straining to hold the injured young man. The tor was a great jumble of earth and stone thrusting up above the tallest trees around it. Their horses scrambled and clattered up the side among the wet boulders. When they reached the small, flat area at the top of the tor where the pack animals huddled together, trembling in the rain, Geryon slid out of his saddle in time to catch Loldrin, who toppled slowly to one side.
"Over here,"
Aunt Paul called sharply. She was pulling her small bundle of herbs and bandages out of one of the packs.
"Durnick, I'll need a fire, at once."
Durnick looked around helplessly at the few scraps of wood lying in the rain at the top of the tor.
"I'll try," he said doubtfully.
Loldrin's breathing was shallow and very fast. His face was still a deadly white, and his legs would not hold him. Geryon held him up, a sick fear in the pit of his stomach. Hetar took the wounded man's other arm, and between them they half-carried him to where Aunt Paul knelt, opening her bundle.
"I have to get the poison out immediately," she told them. "Geryon, give me your knife."
Geryon drew his dagger and handed it to her. Swiftly she ripped open Loldrin's brown tunic along his side, revealing the savage wounds the Algroth's claws had made.
"This will hurt. Hold him."
Geryon and Hetar took hold of Loldrin's arms and legs, holding him down. Aunt Paul took a deep breath and then deftly sliced open each of the puffy wounds. Blood spurted and Loldrin screamed once, then he fainted.
"Hetar!"
Barak shouted from atop a boulder near the edge of the slope.
"We need you."
"Go,"
Aunt Paul told the hawk-faced Algar.
"We can handle this now. Geryon, you stay here."
She was crushing some dried leaves and sprinkling the fragments into the bleeding wounds.
"The fire, Durnick,"
she ordered.
"It won't start, Mistress Paul," Durnick replied helplessly. "It's too wet."
She looked quickly at the pile of sodden wood the smith had gathered. Her eyes narrowed, and she made a quick gesture. Geryon's ears rang strangely, and there was a sudden hissing. A cloud of steam burst from the wood, and then crackling flames curled up from the sticks. Durnick jumped back, startled.
"The small pot, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul instructed.
"And water, quickly."
She pulled off her blue cloak and covered Loldrin with it. Silk, Barak, and Hetar stood at the edge of the slope, heaving large rocks over the edge. Geryon could hear the clatter and clash of the rocks, striking the boulders below, and the barking of the Algroths, punctuated by an occasional howl of pain. He cradled his friend's head in his lap, terribly afraid.
"Is he going to be all right?"
he appealed to Aunt Paul.
"It's too early to tell. Don't bother me with questions just now."
"They're running," Barak shouted.
"They're still hungry,"
Wolf replied grimly.
"They'll be back."
From far off in the forest there came the sound of a brassy horn.
"What's that?"
Silk asked, still puffing from the effort of heaving the heavy stones over the edge.
"Someone I've been expecting,"
Wolf answered, with a strange smile. He raised his hands to his lips and whistled shrilly.
"I can manage now, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul said, mashing a thick paste into a steaming pad of wet linen bandage.
"You and Durnick go help the others."
Reluctantly, Geryon lowered Loldrin's head to the wet turf and ran over to where Wolf stood. The slope below was littered with dead and dying Algroths, crushed by the rocks Barak and the others had hurled down on them.
"They're going to try again,"
Barak said, hefting another rock.
"Can they get at us from behind?"
Silk shook his head.
"No. I checked. The back of the hill is a sheer face."
The Algroths came out of the woods below, barking and snarling as they loped forward with their half-crouched gait. The first of them had already crossed the road when the horn blew again, very close this time. And then a huge horse, bearing a man in full armor, burst out of the trees and thundered down upon the attacking creatures. The armored man crouched over his lance and plunged directly into the midst of the startled Algroths. The great horse screamed as he charged, and his iron-shod hooves churned up big clots of mud. The lance crashed through the chest of one of the largest Algroths and splintered from the force of the blow. The splintered end took another full in the face. The knight discarded the shattered lance and drew his broadsword with a single sweep of his arm. With wide swings to the right and left, he chopped his way through the pack, his war horse trampling the living and the dead alike into the mud of the road. At the end of his charge, he whirled and plunged back again, once more opening a path with his sword. The Algroths turned and fled howling into the woods.
"Bandoralan!" Wolf shouted. "Up here!"
The armored knight raised his blood-spattered visor and looked up the hill.
"Permit me to disperse this rabble first, mine ancient friend," he answered gaily, clanging down his visor and plunging into the rainy woods after the Algroths.
"Hittar!" Barak shouted, already moving.
Hittar nodded tersely, and the two of them ran to their horses. They swung into their saddles and plunged down the wet slope to the aid of the stranger.
"Your friend shows a remarkable lack of good sense," Soke observed to Mr. Wolf, wiping the rain from his face. "Those things will turn on him any second now."
"It's probably not occurred to him that he is in any danger," Wolf replied. "He's a Mimbrate, and they tend to think they're invincible."
The fight in the woods seemed to last for a long time. There were shouts and ringing blows and shrieks of terror from the Algroths. Then Hittar, Barak, and the strange knight rode out of the trees and trotted up the tor. At the top, the armored man clanged down from his horse.
"Well met, mine old friend," he boomed to Mr. Wolf. "My friends below were most frolicsome."
His armor gleamed wetly in the rain.
"I'm glad we found something to entertain you," Wolf said dryly.
"I can still hear them," Durnick reported.
"I think they are still running."
"Their cowardice hath deprived us of an amusing afternoon,"
the knight observed, regretfully sheathing his sword and removing his helmet.
"We must all make sacrifices," Silk drawled.
The knight sighed.
"All too true. Thou art a man of philosophy, I see."
He shook the water out of the white plume on his helmet.
"Forgive me," Mr. Wolf said. "This is Mandoralan, Baron of Volmandor. You'll be going with us. Mandoralan, and this is Prince Keldor of Drasnia, and Barak, Earl of Trelheim, and cousin to King Anheg of Sharak. Over there is Hetar, son of Tohag, chief of the clan chiefs of Algeria. The practical one is Goodman Durnick of Sundaria, and this boy is Geryon, my grandson. Several times removed."
Mandoralan bowed deeply to each of them.
"I greet you, comrades all," he declaimed in a booming voice. "Our adventure hath seen a fortuitous beginning. And pray tell, who is this lady, whose beauty doth bedazzle mine eye?"
"A pretty speech, Sir Knight,"
Aunt Paul replied with a rich laugh, her hand going almost unconsciously to her damp hair.
"I'm going to like this one, father."
"The legendary Lady Pulgera?" Mandoralan asked. "My life has now seen its crown."
His courtly bow was somewhat marred by the creaking of his armor.
"Our injured friend is Lodron, son of the Baron of Wildantor,"
Wolf continued.
"You may have heard of him."
Mandoralan's face darkened slightly.
"Indeed, rumor, which sometimes doth run before us like a barking dog, has suggested that Leldoran of Wildantor hath raised on occasion foul rebellion against the crown."
"That's of no matter now," Wolf stressed. "The business which has brought us together is much more serious than all of that. You will have to put it aside."
"It shall be as you say, noble Bagarath,"
Mandoralan declared immediately, though his eyes still lingered on the unconscious Leldoran.
"Grandfather?"
Geryon called, pointing at a mounted figure that had suddenly appeared on the side of the stony hilltop. The figure was robed in black and set a black horse. He pushed back his hood to reveal a polished steel mask cast in the form of a face that was at once beautiful and strangely repelling. A voice deep in Geryon's mind told him that there was something important about the strange rider, something he should remember, but whatever it was eluded him.
"Abandon this quest, Belgorath."
The voice was hollow behind the mask.
"You know me better than that, Kamdar,"
Mr. Wolf said calmly, quite obviously recognizing the rider.
"Was this childishness with the Algroths your idea?"
"And you should know me better than that,"
the figure retorted derisively.
"When I come against you, you can expect things to be a bit more serious. For now, there are enough underlings about to delay you. That's all we really need. Once Zedar has carried Kradraska to my master, you can try your power against the might and will of Torak, if you'd like."
"Are you running errands for Zedar, then?"
"I run no man's errands,"
the figure replied with a heavy contempt. The rider seemed solid, as real as any of them standing on the hilltop, but Geryon could see the filmy drizzle striking the rocks directly beneath the horse and man. Whatever the figure was, the rain was falling right through it.
"Why are you here, then, Kamdar?"
Wolf demanded.
"Let's call it curiosity, Belgrath. I wanted to see for myself how you would manage to translate the prophecy into everyday terms."
The figure looked around at the others on the hilltop.
"Clever,"
it said with a certain grudging admiration.
"Where did you find them all?"
"I didn't have to find them, Kamdar," Wolf answered. "They have been there all along. If any part of the prophecy is valid, then it all has to be valid, doesn't it? There is no contrivance involved at all. Each one has come down to me through more generations than you can imagine."
The figure seemed to hiss with a sharp intake of its breath.
"It isn't complete yet, old man."
"It will be, Kamdar," Wolf replied confidently. "I have already seen to that."
"Which one is the one who will live twice?"
the figure asked suddenly. Wolf smiled coldly, but did not answer.
"Hail, my queen,"
the figure said mockingly then to Aunt Paul.
"Grolum courtesy always leaves me quite cold," she returned with a frosty look. "I am not your queen, Kamdar."
"You will be, Palgra. My master said that you are to become his wife. When he comes into his kingdom, you will be queen of all the world."
"Well, then that puts you at a bit of a disadvantage, doesn't it, Kamdar? If I'm to become your queen, you can't really cross me now, can you?"
"I can work around you, Balgara. And once you've become the bride of Torak, his will becomes your will. I am sure you won't hold any grudges at this point."
"I think we have had enough of this, Kamdar," Mr. Wolf said. "Your conversation's beginning to bore me. You can have your shadow back now."
He waved his hand negligently, as if brushing away a troublesome fly.
"Go,"
he commanded. Once again Geryon felt that strange surge and that hollow roaring in his mind. The horseman vanished.
"You didn't destroy him, did you?" Silk gasped in a shocked voice.
"No,"
Mr. Wolf told him.
"It was all just an illusion. It's a childish trick the Grolums find impressive. A shadow can be projected over quite some distance if you want to take the trouble. All I did was send his shadow back to him.
He grinned suddenly with a slight twist to his lips.
Of course, I selected a somewhat indirect route. It may take a few days to make the trip. It won't actually hurt him, but it's going to make him a bit uncomfortable and extremely conspicuous.
A most unseemly specter, Mandorallan observed.
Who was this rude shade?
It was Kamdar,
Aunt Paul said, returning her attention to the injured Lulderan.
One of the chief priests of the Grolems. Father and I have met him before.
I think we had better get off of this hilltop. How soon will Lulderan be able to ride?
A week, at least, Aunt Paul replied. If then?
That's out of the question. We cannot stay here.
He can't ride, she told him firmly.
Couldn't we make a litter of some sort? Durnick suggested. I'm sure I can make something we can sling between two horses, so we can move him without hurting him. Well, Paul?
Wolf asked.
It might be all right, she said a little dubiously.
Let's do it, then. We're much too exposed up here, and we've got to move on.
Durnick nodded and went to the packs for rope to use in building the litter. Chapter 7 Sir Mandorallan, Baron of Omandor, was a man of slightly more than medium height. His hair was black and curly, his eyes were deep blue, and he had a resonant voice in which he expressed firmly held opinions. Garion did not like him. The knight's towering self-confidence, an egotism so pure that there was a kind of innocence about it, seemed to confirm the worst of Lulduran's dark pronouncements about Mimbritz. And Mandorallan's extravagant courtesy to Aunt Paul struck Garion as beyond the bounds of proper civility. To make matters even worse, Aunt Paul seemed quite willing to accept the knight's flatteries at face value. As they rode through the continuing drizzle along the Great West Road, Garion noted with some satisfaction that his companions appeared to share his opinion. Barak's expression spoke louder than his words. Silk's eyebrows lifted sardonically at each of the knight's pronouncements, and Durnick scowled. Garion, however, had little time to sort out his feelings about the Mimbret. He rode close beside the litter upon which Lulduran tossed painfully as the Algroth poison seared into his wounds. He offered his friend what comfort he could and exchanged frequent worried looks with Aunt Paul, who rode nearby. During the worst of Lulduran's paroxysms, Garion helplessly held the young man's hand, unable to think of anything else to do to ease the pain.
"Bear thine infirmity with fortitude, good youth,"
Mandorallan cheerfully advised the injured Astorian after a particularly bad bout that left Lulduran gasping and moaning.
"This discomfort of thine is but an illusion. Thy mind can put it to rest if thou wouldst have it so."
"That's exactly the kind of comfort I'd expect from a Mimbret," Lulduran retorted from between clenched teeth. "I think I'd rather you didn't ride so close. Your opinions smell almost as bad as your armor."
Mandorallan's face flushed slightly.
"The venom, which doth rage to the body of our injured friend, hath, it seemed, bereft him of civility as well as sense," he observed coldly.
Lulduran half raised himself in the litter, as if to respond hotly, but the sudden movement seemed to aggravate his injury, and he lapsed into unconsciousness.
His wounds are grave," Mandorallan stated. "Thy poultice, Lady Pulgra, may not suffice to save his life."
"He needs rest. Try not to agitate him so much."
"I will place myself beyond the reach of his eye," Mandorallan replied. "Through no fault of mine own, my visage is hateful to him, and doth stir him to unhealthful choler."
He moved his war horse ahead at a canter until he was some distance in front of the rest of them.
"Do they all talk like that?"
Garion asked with a certain rancor.
"These and thous and doths."
"Mimbrates tend to be very formal," Aunt Paul explained. "You'll get used to it." "I think it sounds stupid," Garion muttered darkly,
glaring after the knight.
An example of good manners won't hurt you all that much, Geryon.
They rode on through the dripping forest as evening settled among the trees.
Aunt Paul?
Geryon asked finally.
Yes, dear.
What was that Grollum talking about when he said that about you and Torak?
It's something Torak said once when he was raving. The Grollums took it seriously, that's all.
She pulled her blue cloak tighter about her.
Doesn't it worry you?
Not particularly.
What was that prophecy the Grollum was talking about?
I didn't understand any of that. The word prophecy, for some reason, stirred something very deep in him.
The Mren Codex. It's a very old version, and the writing's almost illegible. It mentions companions, the bear, the rat, and the man who will live twice. It is the only version that says anything about them. Nobody knows for certain that it really means anything.
Grandfather thinks it does, doesn't he?
Your grandfather has a number of curious notions. Old things impress him, probably because he's so old himself.
Geryon was going to ask her about this prophecy that seemed to exist in more than one version, but Lauldurin moaned then, and they both immediately turned to him. They arrived shortly thereafter at a Tolnedrin hostel, with thick whitewashed walls and a red tile roof. Aunt Paul saw to it that Lauldurin was placed in a warm room, and she spent the night sitting by his bed caring for him. Geryon padded worriedly down the dark hallway in his stockinged feet, a half-dozen times before morning to check on his friend. But there seemed to be no change. By daybreak, the rain had let up. They started out in the grayish dawn with Mandorallan, still riding some distance ahead of them until they reached at last the edge of the dark forest and saw before them the vast open expanse of the Arendish Central Plain, dun-colored and sear in the last few weeks of winter. The knight stopped there and waited for them to join him, his face somber.
"What's the trouble?"
Silk asked him. Mandorallan pointed gravely at a column of black smoke rising from a few miles out on the plain.
"What is it?"
Silk inquired, his rat face puzzled.
"Smoke in Orendia can mean but one thing," the knight replied, pulling on his plumed helmet. "Abide here, dear friends. I will investigate, but I fear the worst."
He set his spurs to the flanks of his charger and leaped forward at a thunderous gallop.
"Wait!"
Barak roared after him, but Mandorallan rode on obliviously.
"That idiot,"
the big Kerak fumed.
"I had better go with him in case there's trouble."
"It isn't necessary,"
Lauldurin advised weakly from his litter.
"Not even an army would dare to interfere with him."
"I thought you didn't like him,"
Beric said, a little surprised.
"I don't," Lauldurin admitted. "But he is the most feared man in Orendia. Even in Astoria we have heard of Sir Mandorallan. No sane man would stand in his way."
They drew back into the shelter of the forest and waited for the knight to come back. When he returned, his face was angry.
"Ah, this is our feared. A war doth rage in our path. A senseless war, since the two barons involved are kinsmen and the best of friends."
"Can we go around it?"
"Nay, Prince Keldor. Their conflict is so widespread that we would be waylaid ere we had gone 3 leagues. I must disappear by us passage."
"Do you think they'll take money to let us pass?"
Durnik asked dubiously.
"In Orendia, there is another way to make such purchase, good man,"
Mandorallan responded.
"May I prevail upon thee to obtain 6 or 8 stout poles, perhaps 20 feet in length and about as thick as my wrist at the butt?"
"Of course."
Durnik took up his axe.
"What have you got in mind?"
Beric rumbled.
"I challenge them,"
Mandorallan announced calmly.
"One or all. No true knight could refuse me without being called craven. Wilt thou be my second and deliver my challenge, my lord?"
And what if you lose? Silk suggested.
Lose?
Mandor Allen seemed shocked.
I? Lose?
Oh, let it pass, Silk said. By the time Durnick had returned with the poles, Mandor Allen had finished tightening various straps beneath his armor. Taking one of the poles, he vaulted into his saddle and started at a rolling trot toward the column of smoke, with Barak at his side.
Is this really necessary, Father?
Aunt Paul asked.
We have to get through, Paul. Don't worry. Mandor Allen knows what he's doing.
After a couple of miles, they reached the top of a hill and looked down at the battle below. Two grim black castles faced each other across a broad valley, and several villages dotted the plain on either side of the road. The nearest village was in flames, with a great pillar of greasy smoke rising from it toward the lead-gray sky overhead. Serfs armed with scythes and pitchforks were attacking each other with a sort of mindless ferocity on the road itself. Some distance off, pikemen were gathering for a charge, and the air was thick with arrows. On two opposing hills, parties of armored knights with bright-colored pennons on their lances watched the battle. Great siege engines lofted boulders into the air to crash down on the struggling men, killing, so far as Geryon could tell, friend and foe indiscriminately. The valley was littered with the dead and the dying.
Stupid, Wolf muttered darkly.
No one I know has ever accused Arryns of brilliance, Silk observed. Mandor Allen set his horn to his lips and blew a shattering blast. The battle paused as the soldiers and serfs all stopped to stare up at him. He sounded his horn again and then again, each brassy note a challenge in itself. As the two opposing bodies of knights galloped through the knee-high winter-yellowed grass to investigate, Mandor Allen turned to Barak.
If it please thee, my lord, he requested politely, deliver my challenge as soon as they approach us.
Barak shrugged.
It's your skin, he noted.
He eyed the advancing knights and then lifted his voice in a great roar.
Sir Mandor Allen, Baron of Vomandor, desires entertainment, he declaimed. It would amuse him if each of your parties would select a champion to joust with him. If, however, you are all such cowardly dogs that you have no stomach for such a contest, cease this brawling and stand aside so that your betters may pass. Oh, splendidly spoken, my lord Barak,
Mandor Allen said with admiration.
I've always had a way with words, Barak replied modestly.
The two parties of knights warily rode closer.
For shame, my lords, Mandor Allen chided them. Ye will gain no honor in this sorry war. So, Darrigan, what hath caused this contention?
An insult, Sir Mandor Allen, the noble replied.
He was a large man, and his polished steel helmet had a golden circlet riveted above the visor.
An insult so vile that it may not go unpunished.
It was I who was insulted,
a noble on the other side contended hotly.
What was the nature of this insult, Sir Otoren? Mandor Allen inquired.
Both men looked away uneasily, and neither spoke.
Ye have gone to war over an insult which cannot even be recalled?
Mandor Allen said incredulously.
I had thought, my lords, that ye were serious men, but I now perceive my error. Don't the nobles of Orendia have anything better to do?
Barak asked in a voice heavy with contempt.
Of Sir Mandor Allen the Bastard, we have all heard, a swarthy knight in black enameled armor sneered. But who is this red-bearded ape who so maligns his betters?
Barak asked Mandor Allen.
You are going to take that? It is more or less true, Mandor Allen admitted with a pained look, since there was some temporary irregularity about my birth, which still raises questions about my legitimacy.
This knight is Sir Haldoran, my third cousin, twice removed. Since it's considered unseemly in Arendia to spill the blood of kinsmen, he thus cheaply gains reputation for boldness by casting the matter in my teeth.
That's a stupid custom, Beric grunted. In Kerak, kinsmen kill each other with more enthusiasm than they kill strangers.
Alas, Mandorallan sighed. This is not Kerak.
Would you be offended if I dealt with this? Beric asked politely.
Not at all.
Beric moved closer to the swarthy knight.
I am Beric, Earl of Trelheim, he announced in a loud voice, kinsman to King Anheg of Kerak, and I see that certain nobles in Arendia have even fewer manners than they have brains.
The lords of Arendia are not impressed by the self-bestowed titles of the pigsty kingdoms of the north, Sir Haldoran retorted coldly.
I find your words offensive, friend, Beric said ominously.
And I find thy ape-face and scraggly beard amusing, Sir Haldoran replied.
Beric did not even bother to draw his sword. He swung his huge arm in a wide circle and crashed his fist with stunning force against the side of the swarthy knight's helmet. Sir Haldoran's eyes glazed as he was swept from the saddle, and he made a vast clatter when he struck the ground.
Would anyone else like to comment about my beard? Beric demanded.
Oh, gently, my lord, Mandorallan advised. He glanced down with a certain satisfaction at the unconscious form of his senseless kinsman twitching in the tall grass.
Will we docilely accept this attack on our brave companion?
One of the knights in Baron Derrigan's party demanded in a harshly accented voice.
Kill them all!
He reached for his sword.
On the instant thy sword leaves its sheath, thou art a dead man, Sir Knight,
Mandorallan coolly advised him. The knight's hand froze on his sword hilt.
For shame, my lords,
Mandorallan continued accusingly.
Surely ye know that by courtesy and common usage, my challenge, until it is answered, guarantees my safety and that of my companions. Choose your champions or withdraw. I tire of all of this and presently will become irritable.
The two parties of knights pulled back some distance to confer, and several men-at-arms came to the hilltop to pick up Sir Haldoran.
That one who was going to draw his sword was a Murgo,
Geryon said quietly.
I noticed that,
Hetar murmured, his dark eyes glittering.
Aye, they're coming back, Durnick warned. I will joust thee, Sir Mandorallan,
Baron Derrigan, as he approached.
I doubt not that thy reputation is well deserved, but I also have taken the prize in no small number of tourneys. I would be honored to try a lance with thee.
On part two will try my skill against thine, Sir Knight, Baron Alterain declared. My arm is also feared in some parts of Arendia.
Oh, very well, Mandorallan replied. Let us seek level ground and proceed. The day wears on, and my companions and I have business to the south.
They all rode down the hill to the field below, where the two groups of knights drew up on either side of a course which had been quickly trampled out in the high yellow grass. Zarajan galloped to the far end, turned, and sat waiting, his blunted lance resting in his stirrup.
Thy courage becomes thee, my lord,
Mandorallan called, taking up one of the poles Durnick had cut.
I shall try not to injure thee too greatly. Art thou prepared to meet my charge?
I am,
the baron replied, lowering his visor. Mandorallan clapped down his visor, lowered his lance, and set his spurs to his warhorse.
It's probably inappropriate under the circumstances, Silk murmured, but I can't help wishing that our overbearing friend could suffer some humiliating defeat.
Mr. Wolf gave him a withering look.
Forget it.
Is he that good?
Silk asked wistfully.
Watch,
Wolf told him. The two knights met in the center of the course with a resounding crash, and their lances both shattered at the stunning impact, littering the trampled grass with splinters. They thundered past each other, turned, and rode back, each to his original starting place.
Derevin,
Geryon noticed, swayed somewhat in the saddle as he rode. The knights charged again, and their fresh lances also shattered.
Dernick said thoughtfully, I should have cut more poles.
But Baron Derevin swayed even more as he rode back this time, and on the third charge his faltering lance glanced off Mandrollen's shield. Mandrollen's lance, however, struck true, and the Baron was hurled from his saddle by the force of their meeting. Mandrollen reined in his charger and looked down at him.
"Art thou able to continue, my lord?"
he asked politely. Garajan staggered to his feet.
"I do not yield," he gasped, drawing his sword.
"Splendid," Mandrollen replied. "I feared that I might have done thee harm."
He slid out of his saddle, drew his sword, and swung directly at Derevin's head. The blow glanced off the Baron's hastily raised shield, and Mandrollen swung again without pause. Derevin managed one or two feeble swings before Mandrollen's broadsword caught him full on the side of the helmet. He spun once and collapsed face down on the earth.
"My lord?"
Mandrollen inquired solicitously. He reached down, rolled over his fallen opponent, and opened the dented visor of the Baron's helmet.
"Art thou unwell, my lord? Dost thou wish to continue?"
He did not reply. Blood ran freely from his nose, and his eyes were rolled back in his head. His face was blue, and the right side of his body quivered spasmodically.
Since this brave knight is unable to speak for himself, I declare him vanquished.
He looked around, his broadsword still in his hand.
Would any here gainsay my words?
There was a vast silence.
Will some few then remove him from the field?
Mandrollen suggested.
His injuries do not appear grave. A few months in bed should make him whole again.
He turned to Baron Ultoren, whose face had grown visibly pale.
"Well, my lord, shall we proceed?"
he said cheerfully.
"My companions and I are impatient to continue our journey."
Sir Ultoren was thrown to the ground on the first charge, and broke his leg as he fell.
Ill luck, my lord,"
Mandrollen observed, approaching on foot with his drawn sword.
"Dost thou yield?"
"I cannot stand,"
Ultoren said from between clenched teeth.
"I have no choice but to yield."
"And I and my companions may continue our journey?"
"You may freely depart,"
the man on the ground replied painfully.
"Not just yet,"
a harsh voice interrupted. The armored Murgo pushed his horse through the crowd of other mounted knights, until he was directly in front of Mandrollen.
"I thought he might decide to interfere,"
Aunt Paul said quietly. She dismounted and stepped out onto the hoof-churned course.
"Move out of the way, Mandrollen," she told the knight.
"Nay, my lady,"
Mandrollen protested. Wolf barked sharply.
"Move, Mandrollen."
Mandrollen looked startled and stepped aside.
"Well, Grolum,"
Aunt Paul challenged, pushing back her hood. The mounted man's eyes widened as he saw the white lock in her hair, and then he raised his hand almost despairingly, muttering rapidly under his breath. Once again Geryon felt that strange surge, and the hollow roaring filled his mind. For an instant Aunt Paul's figure seemed surrounded by a kind of greenish light. She waved her hand indifferently, and the light disappeared.
"You must be out of practice," she told him. "Would you like to try again?"
The Grolem raised both hands this time, but got no further. Maneuvering his horse carefully behind the armored man, Dernick had closed on him.
With both hands he raised his axe and smashed it down directly on top of the Grolem's helmet.
"Darnik!" Aunt Paul shouted. "Get away!"
But the smith, his face set grimly, swung again, and the Grolem slid senseless from his saddle with a crash.
"You fool!" Aunt Paul raged. "What do you think you are doing?"
"He was attacking you, Mistress Paul," Durnick explained, his eyes still hot.
"Get down off that horse."
He slid down.
"Do you have any idea how dangerous that was? He could have killed you."
"I will protect you, Mistress Paul," Durnick replied stubbornly. "I'm not a warrior or a magician, but I won't let anybody try to hurt you."
Her eyes widened in surprise for an instant, then narrowed, then softened. Geryon, who had known her from childhood, recognized her rapid changes of emotion. Without warning, she suddenly embraced the startled Durnick.
"You great, clumsy, dear fool! Never do that again! Never! You almost made my heart stop!"
Geryon looked away with a strange lump in his throat and saw the brief, sly smile that flickered across Mr. Wolf's face. A peculiar change had come over the knights lining the sides of the course. Several of them were looking around with amazed expressions of men who had just been roused from some terrible dream. Others seemed suddenly lost in thought. Sir Altharain struggled to rise.
"Nay, my lord,"
Mandrollen told him, pressing him gently back down.
"Thou wilt do thyself injury."
"What have we done?"
the Baron groaned, his face anguished. Mr. Wolf dismounted and knelt beside the injured man.
"It wasn't your fault," informed the Baron.
"Your war was the Murgos' doing. It twisted your minds and set you on each other."
"Sorcery!"
Altharain gasped, his face growing pale. Wolf nodded.
"He's not really a Murgo, but a Grolem priest."
"And the spell is now broken?"
Wolf nodded again, glancing at the unconscious Grolem.
"Chain that Murgo,"
the Baron ordered the assembled knights. He looked back at Wolf.
"We have ways of dealing with sorcerers," he said grimly. "We will use the occasion to celebrate the end of our unnatural war. This Grolem sorcerer has cast his last enchantment."
"Good," Wolf replied with a bleak smile.
"Sir Mandrelin,"
Baron Altharain said, wincing as he shifted his broken leg.
"In what way may we repay thee and thy companions for bringing us to our senses?"
"That peace has been restored is reward enough,"
the Baron replied somewhat pompously.
"For as all the world knows, I am the most peace-loving man in the kingdom."
He glanced once at Lodoran, lying nearby on the ground in his litter, and a thought seemed to occur to him.
"I would, however, ask a boon of thee. We have in our company a brave Asturian youth of noble family who hath suffered grievous injury. We would leave him, if we might, in thy care."
"His presence shall honor me, Sir Mandrelin,"
Altharain assented immediately.
"The women of my household will care for him most tenderly."
He spoke briefly to one of his retainers, and the man mounted and rode quickly toward one of the nearby castles. Lodoran protested weakly.
"You're not going to leave me behind. I'll be able to ride in a day or so."
He began to cough rackingly.
"I think not," Mandrelin disagreed with a cool expression. "The results of thy wounding have not yet run their natural course."
"I won't stay with Mimbritz,"
Lodoran insisted.
"I would rather take my chances on the road."
"Young Lodoran,"
Mandrelin replied bluntly, even harshly.
"I know thy distaste for the men of Mimbre. Thy wound, however, will soon begin to abscess and then suppurate, and raging fever and delirium will afflict thee, making thy presence a burden upon us. We have not the time to care for thee, and thy sore need would delay us in our quest."
Geryon gasped at the brutal directness of the knight's words. He glared at Manarallan with something very close to hatred. Lotharan's face, meanwhile, had gone white.
Thank you for pointing that out to me, Sir Manarallan. I should have considered it myself. If you will help me to my horse, I'll leave immediately. You will stay right where you are,
Aunt Paul told him flatly. Baron Altarain's retainer returned with a group of household servants and a blonde girl of about 17 wearing a rose-colored gown of stiff brocade and a velvet cloak of teal.
My younger sister, Lady Arianna, Altarain introduced her. She is a spirited girl, and though she is young, she is already well-versed in the care of the sick.
I won't trouble her for long, my lord,
Lalduran declared. I will be returning to Astoria within a week.
Lady Arianna laid a professional hand to his forehead.
Nay, good youth. Thy visit, I think, will be protracted.
I'll leave within the week,
Lalduran repeated stubbornly. She shrugged.
As it pleases thee. I expect that my brother will be able to spare some few servants to follow after thee, to provide thee that decent burial which, if I misjudge not, thou wilt require before thou hast gone 10 leagues.
Lalduran blinked. Aunt Paul took Lady Arianna to one side and spoke with her at some length, giving her a small packet of herbs and certain instructions. Lalduran motioned to Geryon, and Geryon went to him immediately and knelt beside the litter.
And so it ends,
the young man murmured.
I wish I could go with you. You'll be well in no time at all,
Geryon assured him, knowing that it was not true.
Maybe you can catch up with us later.
Lalduran shook his head.
No. I am afraid not.
He began to cough again, the spasms seeming to tear at his lungs.
We don't have much time, my friend. So, listen carefully.
Geryon, near tears, took his friend's hand.
You remember what we were talking about that morning after we left my uncle's house?
Geryon nodded.
You said that I was the one who would have to decide if we were to break our pledge to Tarasin and the others to keep silent.
I remember,
Geryon told him.
All right. I have decided. I release you from your pledge. Do what you have to do.
It would be better if you told my grandfather about it yourself, Lotharin.
I can't, Geryon. The words would stick in my throat. I'm sorry, but that's the way I am. I know that Natchak's only using us, but I gave the others my word. I am an Arend, Geryon. I will keep my word even though I know it is wrong. So it is up to you. You are going to have to keep Natchak from destroying my country. I want you to go straight to the king himself.
To the king?
Oh, he'd never believe me. Make him believe you. Tell him everything.
Geryon shook his head firmly.
I won't tell him your name, or Terrison's. You know what he'd do to you if I did.
We do not matter,
Lotharin insisted, coughing again.
I'll tell him about Natchak,
Geryon said stubbornly,
but not about you. Where do I tell him to find this Murgo?